And secondly, thank you very much for listening in my language, which will be much easier for us all than trying to do it the other way around. What I'm going to talk about, so that's who I am, is I'm going to talk about e-universities in general, but one specific one which we're in the process of founding, as has been explained to you, which is called, this horrible mouthful, UK e-universities worldwide. We've actually just bought the web address UKEU, so it's not that mouthful on the web. If you want to find out more, it's UKEU.com. But I'm going to talk about a couple of things just to put this in context first, as to what we're doing, and then I'll go and talk more generally about e-universities. Now, I inevitably may use colloquialisms in my language, so please, if I say something that you do not understand, because I'm using silly English, can you jump in and stop me, and I'll try and translate into real English. So what is this thing called UKEU? It's a vehicle for all UK universities, but for various technical reasons to do with our funding. We're four bits. Three of the bits are funding us originally. That's Wales, Northern Ireland, and England. And Scotland isn't for a while yet, so Scottish universities can't play just yet. And we're in the business of developing and delivering courses which are delivered primarily by electronic means, over the web, and we will have our own delivery platform, which is actually being developed using bringing together various components by Sun Microsystems. And for those of you that don't know Sun, they make big Unix boxes. That probably hasn't helped. Are most people familiar with Sun boxes in one form or another? Yeah, I imagine they're a major supplier to this university as well. And the other thing we have is extensive access to know-how in those universities that are advanced. We're acquiring 40 odd staff, and have been lucky to get the person that runs the platform for Oxford to join us, and a few other things along those lines. And we're trying to put in place what I believe is one of the key messages I'd like to get over, which is you need in place a lot of support for learners. You shouldn't assume you can put it there and then say to a learner, come back in 27 years when you've finished it, or whatever it is. You've actually got to think through supporting learners doing this kind of learning. And for various technical reasons to do with our what you need to be in order to teach HE in the UK, we need a quality assurance regime. Light touch means that we rely mainly on the quality regime of the universities that are putting the courses together. So, a little bit about my background. Before I joined this organisation, I was a Pro Vice Chancellor at one of our universities, at University of Kent at Canterbury. The other thing you need, because one of our aims is to market worldwide, is appropriate support wherever it is your learners are. And so you need partners in some of the countries we want to deliver in, typically to provide tutorials, but a lot of the countries you also need permissions to operate. You can't just go and say, hello, I'm the University of wherever, we're now offering degrees in somewhere, China, for instance. You have to get appropriate permissions from the local governments or whatever. So I'm going to get on to the generality. Oh, sorry. The other thing that the government's given us about 100 million euros to set this up. Our government. Well, actually, the English government, not the UK government. And that causes universities to want to talk to us. Can't think why. So what we started about a year ago, though no courses are live yet. The first ones will go live in 2003, January. We issued a call saying who would like, which universities would like to play this game, who would like to offer courses through our environment, and we got 84 saying yes. We selected 11 to negotiate with on the basis of what might work, and we've selected 3 to launch with next January. The 3 programmes we'll be launching with are one which is a joint development of Cambridge and our Open University on learning in the connected economy. So it's actually a master's level course about distance learning, so there's an element of recursion in there. The second is a business and IT course offered from Sheffield Hallam. And the third is a social policy course offered by York, Manchester and Leeds, and with partners in the US. So we've got 3 programmes well developed starting, and they're all postgraduate first level, level 1 masters. I'm sorry, translating that's quite... In the new Bologna framework, these are masters level 1, level 4, whatever. And we're currently negotiating 5 more, of which 4 are also at postgraduate level. The only undergraduate one we're currently negotiating is computing with Oxford. Slightly odd that Oxford should be the only one of our initial set that's offering at undergraduate level. All of these programmes are divided into appropriate size chunks of typically... Are you happy with CATS credit points? No. ECTS points. Typically an eighth of a year in full-time undergraduate terms. So they're each capable of division up. And at the moment we're trying to find more courses to follow, and we're following a policy of thickening up in health, business and IT. So I've yanked those out of what's going to be a presentation in order to give context. What I'd now like to do is go back and talk about things more generally, but I think with that... Interesting. The overview seems to have lost an O. What I'm going to do then is talk about the background. What do we mean by one of these things called an e-university? What partners do you need? Because if you're going to set up an e-university, it's a very expensive thing to do on your own. Most of the university budgets I know find it very difficult to do it by yourselves in anything like the scale that's needed. What programs might you have? I'm going to talk a bit about, I mentioned the CATS credit points, the need to be able to break things up to allow the distance learning student often wants to go through things in slightly different orders and in slightly different paces, particularly if you're trying to meet particular needs of bodies. I obviously would like to have some discussion about what the motivator for wanting to do this, whether it's entirely driven by altruism or whether there is a motive other than altruism, and there are models that take both routes. A bit about what you need to support by way of a platform, a bit about what research you might want to do if you're setting up one of these things, and then a bit about the future. So let's move on to background. And again, this is in a context. Why did the English government set this up? It was perceived as being a big market for e-learning throughout the world. This market is very large in certain key countries, mainly to the east, and it's a market that's largely involved in English speaking. There is a large Spanish speaking market in Latin America as well, which Catalonia is doing incredibly well at addressing. But there aren't many other outside Europe large markets, though there are large markets within Europe. Sorry, that's just me being rude to the French, and you wouldn't expect an Englishman not to be. The UK has been losing the market share. We're actually seeing our overseas students go up in numbers slightly, but the market is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So we are losing, at the moment, market share. And you can ask who we're losing it to, and I'll come back to that. Essentially, it's our own former bits, like Australia and primarily Australia and Canada, though a bit to New Zealand and other former colonies like the United States. So the government put up 100 million, and this was just in 2000, and at the time one of the main motivations was to encourage public sector working with private sector, and we call these public-private partnerships, and they're responsible for many great creations like our railway system. So with that was the motivator. So Tony Blair said, can we get some more market share overseas? At the same time, there was a separate piece of agenda, which is our Secretary of State for Education said, we want to expand the 18 to 21 year old cohort involved in education from currently 32% of our population going through higher education to 50% by 2008. That's the target that we set for higher education in England and Wales and Northern Ireland, not in Scotland. The intention was at the same time to try and redress some of the imbalances that we have to make that population more representative of the population in a number of ways to do with social mix, minorities, etc. And there was a subtext that he didn't want to fund any more research pro rata, and he didn't want to fund any more hotels. Sorry, most of our universities are residential. Yeah? And most of our universities make their biggest profits by selling beer. If you look at the business of a UK university, as someone that used to be responsible, the most profitable thing that universities do is house people and sell them food and especially drink. Right? The research and teaching are just sort of lost leaders in our... It doesn't feel like that when you sit where you sit, but so there's a tension between the government that wants to fund more teaching but doesn't want to fund more of the buildings and all of that. So, what is an e-university? The first thing is, and the one that many competitors in the US especially forget, is it's a university. All right? To be a university, you've got to cover a fair amount of ground. You've got to have appropriate value sets that fit with being a university. You've got to have an imprimatur. You've got to be able to lay on hands and grant awards to people. Yes, you're licensed to give degrees. And that's something where most universities in most European states still have a monopoly, which they exploit dramatically. It's got to have appropriate support structures for learners. You don't want to get a bad name because of a piece of operation that is not quality assured or doesn't have proper support. But what I'm saying is, an e-university is a university, but clearly there are other universities. It would typically indulge in distance learning, but there are plenty of others that do that, such as the UK's Open University and other open universities. And it's primarily delivering using web-based means. But there are other people that do that, particularly corporate trainers. You know, the Cisco's. Has a Cisco Academy hit Austria? No. There are large organizations like Cisco who make networks, who are offering graduate level training and are offering to franchise higher education establishments to deliver their training, which is a complete reversal from the way it used to be, where it was in the higher it was the Cisco chasing the universities. Now in some countries the universities chase Cisco. So there are these three things which you add together, and it's doing all three that makes something an e-university. That it's a university delivering primarily by web means and distance delivery. Okay, the next... So go back to the we were losing market share. Since we were losing market share, last year the number of overseas students actually coming to the United Kingdom went up by 24%. So that without doing this, we're meeting all the targets that Tony Blair set us. That's good. Universities and states or substructures are about the most best exploiters of monopoly provision that there can be. You know, sort of, there are countries in which there aren't monopoly provision, but in which case it breaks down. But the ability to control is something that universities are very good at. And some of our former colonies, territories, etc., have not done quite so well. And in particular, a number of competitors, especially in the States, have had great difficulty with the kind of model we might be talking about. Getting companies to invest has proved since last summer and the downturn in the dot-bomb area to be quite hard. And in common with the rest of Europe, universities have been suffering from large cuts for a number of years and are finding doing anything new at the margin quite difficult to resource. And knowledge business is in trouble and public partnerships are in trouble. So you may well ask, why are we carrying on? And the answer is because we still think there is a model and there is a job to be done, especially within the UK, in helping deliver that expansion of the cohort. I'd now like to talk about why you need partners and who those partners might be. Right? And there are two sorts of partners that you can think of if you're setting one of these things up. Two sorts of partners you might think to involve. One is those colleagues in the public sector, the essentially government funded, and the other is people from industry or the private sector. So clearly there's government, and our government is actually quite interventionist and does actually have quite a bit of money to give and played a major role in setting us up. In other words, government is not a vacuous layer that just shuffles money around. We have funding bodies, other funding bodies. We have the possibility of overseas government help under the right circumstances. Sorry, overseas is a technical term, which I don't know whether... overseas means not in the EU, if you're where we are, because of different fee structures are appropriate. There are bodies in regions such as... So are less developed regions such as the Highlands and Islands, who have funds that are keen to see some of our distance learning things work. So in remote areas of the Celtic countries, there's a lot of distance problems, more distance than learning. There's global broadcasters, so we have the BBC, who will help us with broadcasting as they help the Open University. Obviously, we've got universities as the major partner you need, and we've got marketing organisations and support resources, because you need to put quite a bit of effort into the supporting resources. If you've got, for instance, some data that you're licensing for use in Austria, it's not clear that that license will hold good in wherever, some other country. You've got to have an organisation that knows about getting permissions and dealing with rights and the like. When we come to the cowboys in the private sector, we've got venture capitalists, you might add. People might buy shares. Lots of people will tell you that they would love to market your courses as soon as you've got them. We've got publishers who have a different model of how any university might work, and I'm going to talk briefly in a minute. We've got IT partners. We've got people offering help overseas. We've got the trainers that I talked about saying, what we'd really like to do is give you our training course, and we'd like the University of, I don't know, Cambridge to stamp it as theirs. That doesn't go down at all well. So the people that make you that kind of offer. And some universities also act commercially. Now, you'll gather if you can read vertically. For those of you that have read the first... if I went back to the previous one, it said good guys, that there's a value set maybe that comes from a traditional university in here, that there might be other people. Just like to dwell on that content model for a bit. There's currently an initiative called the Open Courseware Initiative that some of you may have heard of at MIT. And what they're saying they will do is put all their material on the web freely, and they're encouraging other universities to do the same. And it looks like this kills the whole game, but it doesn't. What it does do is kill somebody that thinks that this learning is about content, that thinks that it's about the material and only the material. If you look at where the value points are, what do people perceive in value? And I'll talk about MIT, because it's... A student sees value in being accepted by MIT. Even without going there, there's value in MIT having said, we'll take you as a student. MIT's not giving that away. The next thing of value is... they perceive value in being taught in tutorial groups or the electronic equivalent by people at MIT. But they stupidly think by lecturers at MIT. In practice, it's probably the same mix of graduate students, etc., that they get anywhere else, but they don't realize that. It's the MIT is guiding my personal development, tutorial development. That's a second value point. The third thing is, they value being in a group, either in a working together with other people who MIT has accepted. So, because they've gone through, they're like me, yes? They're me, because I'm all right, and I know I'm all right. MIT's accepted me, MIT's accepted them, so they're all right. Yeah? So that there's value perceived in being in a group of people that have been quality stamped in some way. The fourth value point is they perceive value in getting an award from MIT, the actual piece of paper or whatever it is. Yeah, that's the one that's obvious. Yeah, and the fifth thing is they perceive value in what are called tickets in certain parts of... a ticket is a license to do something, so that if it were a professional development qualification, it would get you... allow you to stay practicing as a lawyer. So if you've got this qualification, then you can do this. A good one is that there are some nursing qualifications available that get you fast track entry into the US. These sell very well in the Philippines, where the real requirement is to get into the US. So those are the five value points that market research says people do things. I'm sure that there are some people that come for learning, but you notice that didn't actually feature too much in the discussion. But the actual perceived value points of why people undertake any form of HE, those are the five leading things, and you'll notice MIT is giving precisely none of those away through this initiative. So don't concentrate too much on the courseware. Concentrate on where you have value. And you have value as a brand. You have value in all of those five things, providing you can get the right support structures in place. And that's the key. Okay, let's talk about what universities do then. I've already indicated that the main thing universities do is lay hands on people and say, you've now got one of our degrees. That's the main value that students perceive in a university. Sad, but that's the way it is. You have brand. They actually differentiate between your university and somebody else's university. Though you have to be very careful about brand. We have a concept mentioned called the Russell Group, which is a group of the 20, it's defined loosely as the 21 universities in England, or in England and Scotland, each of which thinks it's in the top 12. So it's the 21 top universities. Of those, when you go internationally, maybe four or five of them survive as brand. No more. You know, that if you were to name top English universities, you'd probably come up with three or four. And if you weren't in the university business, you'd probably come up with three or four. Most people would come up with two. Interestingly, one of the universities that does come up as a brand is our Open Worldwide, is our Open University, which isn't a member of that group. So the brand is a peculiar thing. London is also a brand, which is inherited by universities that have London in their title, even if they're not part of the University of London. So capital cities, as you're no doubt well aware, carry brand. You know, people have heard of capitals. Quality assurance regimes matter to some people. So that you do need to have, clearly the main role is to develop and deliver learning. That's a key role for a university. Equally important is the organisation and provision of the support structures that you need. And finally, they can provide services, and many of our universities have already got substantial partners overseas. Interestingly enough, one or two of our partners, the partners of our universities, have just gone bankrupt in America. There's been a considerable downturn in. But one could buy all of these services from universities who are quite expert at them. Something else that you need to do if you're engaging in big delivery to the world is you actually need a method of delivering material that isn't electronic reliably around the world, and that's actually quite a difficult job, especially in countries like India, where stuff needs customs clearing and all of that kind of, and you need expertise, which universities have, and training. So what have we chosen? Well, we've chosen cash from government. That's a no-brainer, as they say. If the government offers you cash, why go and get it from anywhere else? We've chosen that universities that work with us can either use our platform or they can use their platform. So it's a hybrid platform. But we give the ones that work with ours rather more money than if they work with somebody else's. We've chosen a few partners from content provision. The publishing world is very keen to come along and say, you get your academics to give you the course and then leave the reading list to us. And that's not acceptable, as I'm sure some of you smiling will realise. You know, the supporting content is as important and as integral, and the choice of that has to belong with the academic function. We do, however, need overseas marketing partners to try and market your university in places like Beijing without a local partner is not really on. And I suppose you can view our development as being an attempt to only do that once or twice for the UK on behalf of all universities, rather than for each university to have its own outpost. And we have currently about 20 that do have offices in Beijing. We're starting with postgraduate work. As you've seen, largely it was first year postgraduate, master's level, and continuing professional development, sort of the ability to, many of our professions like solicitors require people to do so many days of updating each year in order to continue to be, and engineers and others have similar organisations. The trouble with most of those is that the requirement is only to do so many days. The quality is rarely looked at. So that, and selected disaggregation, and I'm going to come back to what I mean by disaggregation in a minute. So let's talk about disaggregation. What do I mean? It's a horrible word. This is the ability to divide things up. I don't know, in your school system, does the body that examines school children at the end, is it a school body? So it's, the schools do it themselves. Gosh. In England, it's completely disaggregated. We have separate bodies that examine, that set the national exams and mark them, and are not the schools. So that's an example of, and that's quite a common model. Universities are probably unique in our country as being the only ones that still self-regulate, examine their own courses. Not saying you should disaggregate. We have two exceptions to that. They're rather artificial. Oxford and Cambridge set their own exams, but the students are all prepared by individual colleges. We have, so one can think to divide up content. That's the first way. Just, you do that module, you do that module, and so on. We do that routinely when we're dividing out who teaches what within a university. If you do subdivide content, the possibility, let's suppose you take a management course from one university, one or two of those modules, I'd say an eighth of a degree, might be suitable for inclusion in somebody else's course, and you can facilitate that. And I think you probably, it goes with this concept that credit can be transferred from body to body. And it goes with sort of, it goes with Europeanism in that sense, that the ECTS, European Credit Transfer System, was developed to allow Erasmus and other exchanges to take place. But the same concepts will work. You can think to disaggregate assessment. You can think to disaggregate material. You could think to have different people advising people on what products to do. As soon as you've got courses from more than one organisation, somebody who isn't one of those organisations has to advise. I mean, it's the problem of who in your university says, don't come to our university, there's a much better degree somewhere else, is not a natural thing to say. You need to take out the advice function or navigation and put it somewhere else. As a result of having all of this, we need to have in place a university that we were originally going to call an accreditor of last resort, which didn't actually go down too well. No university wants to be the sort of last choice saloon type accreditor. So the idea was that we'd have an accreditor that would accredit and give a degree for pathways that were constructed of different pieces. It's likely to be with our Open University. And the other thing that you might do is, if you've got a platform, you might think, and I'll explain the... If you're delivering around the world, you're dealing with students who are available in different time frames, maybe from the ones you're used to supporting in, and at different times, and the being told that I'm sorry, it's Christmas, doesn't go down too well. If you're in China, it goes down even less well in the Gulf. So you have to have a service provided by somebody, and we're actually rather bad at this, which is available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and which has a service level agreement that says if something goes wrong, it will get fixed within so many hours or so many minutes. I'm going to come back to that when I talk about support. and quality assurance. And sometimes this is better if this is not done by the university, because most university services exist to service on-campus people at times that they know are people will do things, and not at times when they think people won't, such as Christmas Day or Friday evening. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about, as well as having courses that were helping make, so the money behind, the motive behind some of the selling courses overseas is in part a profit motive. It isn't totally a profit motive, because we believe that actually having people come and be educated has benefits that are benefits to our country that aren't immediately cash at the time related. So there are ongoing benefits. We had a brief period when we had a prime minister that thought otherwise, but she's moved on. We have. Our government is now saying we have a fairly controlled student numbers system, that universities are allowed to recruit so many. And as part of meeting that 32% to 50% objective, student numbers are being given away for working with us. The government is making more student places available, but only for electronic delivery. That's part of the "we don't want to build more hotels" syndrome. Many of these courses are not, because the requirement is for, I chose my words carefully, I hope, earlier. Many of these courses, are for level one undergraduate exit. And I'm sorry, that's a term that, as a result of the Bologna Declaration, you're going to have to get to grips with. It's first year bachelor's. So the requirement is only for 50% of people to be doing higher education. They don't have to get through to a bachelor's. Yeah? So a lot of these courses start in year one, and there are reasons for that, in that often we're seeing models where students want to stay at home for 1 year prior to coming to a university. That's the first statement. Second statement is that groups of universities can generally agree fairly readily on a common first-year bachelor's content. So if you get all the medieval dentists in, say, the northwest of England together, or at least if you get all the medieval dentists in good universities in the northwest of England together, then they can agree on a common first-year bachelor's course in medieval dentistry. But as soon as you get to the second year, and there's enormous gulfs as to what really constitutes the essence of medieval dentistry, or philosophy, or whatever it is, yeah? Yeah, you get religion about the content once you get beyond first year undergraduate level. In all subjects. So the market is often for a first year, and we're looking at groups of universities sharing a common output of first year bachelors, which would then enable students both at home and overseas to move in. So we're encouraging partnerships. And we have a system whereby there are extra government money for students with certain characteristics. So adult learners attract, I think, a 15% premium. Our government gives the university 15% more to teach a student who's over 25 than it does one who's under 25. Definition of adult, 25. Yeah. We also have premium for students with impairment. So, for teaching sight impaired or hearing impaired students, carry extra sums of money. More recently, we've introduced one that depends on the zip code. So you get more money if your zip code indicates that you're likely to come from a social background which is not standard. So that and that's been politically controversial. I'm trying to give it you valuelessly, and I'm probably failing. But the idea is that we want to encourage a more cohesive social mix doing HE. So in order to encourage people from less privileged backgrounds, you give the universities more for taking people. But don't go there. There are a number of issues, I accept that, but the other premier are fairly clear. And they're attracted even if the student is a distance learner. There's a need to keep the courses that make profits separate for funding reasons for the ones that are for public good. I'll not unpack that unless anyone asks. Let's talk about the platform. Sun are actually giving us a large hunk of hardware and a big development and various other things. That's part of... And Epic is a large software house in the UK, and a group of about 7 or 8 universities are helping develop the platform. The universities are approximately the Open University, Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, York, Bristol, Southampton, and Sheffield Hallam. Probably missed one, but that'll do. We need the university input because it really isn't sufficient to just stick it up there. I'm trying to persuade you that what really matters is that you support the right pedagogic structures for teaching higher education. Yeah, which is the group work and all that goes therewith. And we want that support for threaded discussions so that there can be questions and answers and the like built into the platform, and the monitoring of those built into the platform, so that we can look at the performance of people supporting learners to see how quickly they responded and that kind of issue, and also which learners, support research, as we'll see. And we want the support for the quality regimes of the universities integrated, nearly through. And we've got... I'll dwell on the platform if people want me to, but it's fairly boring. It's a decent architecture, and we need to integrate with alumni systems and admin data. There are also issues of standard performance. If you've got a big platform with what we hope will be about 100,000 students on it, you need... efficiency begins to matter, and dealing with standards, of which those are the two main areas of standards for teaching material score, well, they both come out of the States, but IMS is currently in meeting in, well, as of tomorrow, IMS is meeting in Boston. There are a large number of things like WebCT and Blackboard. We're beginning to see the market shake out. It's a bit like word processors were 15 years ago. If 15 years ago I'd said to you, hands up, tell me what word processor you use, and I'd gone round, I'd got about 10 or 11 different products. Now I imagine I'll get one and a bit, the one being Word. I'm doing the bit in case you're all thinking, I don't use Word. But products like Blackboard and WebCT, we're seeing lots of them go out of business, and we're probably going to see a couple of them within a few years. It's a question of what those couple are going to be. We do see, and I'm sorry I'm dwelling on it quite a lot, standards beginning to emerge for those areas. And the example that I've given twice today already, but I'll give it a third time, is e-learning is actually useful for some cultures and minorities, even if they're on campus. So there are some groups that will take part in discussions if they're on the web, and not take part if you sit them down in a room. Yeah. Often they're Asian and female, or of Asian origin. We have to go through a proper procurement for anything we do, because we're essentially more public sector than private sector, and we're looking at emerging products. Let's talk a bit about... we've got a research program. We've appointed somebody who's reasonably well known in the English-speaking world because of her work in supporting tutorial-type learning on the net. with a small team, and again we're trying to build in the hooks into the platform that we will need for the research. And the intention of the research is to do all of these things. So we're going to continue to develop the platform to support research. And what's clear is that we don't know, we as a world don't know anything like enough about the learner profiles that distance learners go through. There's a lot of research on individual things, but longitudinal research just doesn't exist, because learners unfortunately flit around all over the place. So actually designing an experiment is not too easy. The quality assurance aspects are quite important. We believe that we want to use the university's quality assurance procedures, but that most universities don't have what we require in place yet. So it's not up to us to say if somebody asks a question of one of your tutors, they should respond within. What it is up to us to say is you, university of wherever, should have a standard for that. And you should be monitoring against it, and you should know which of your tutors are not responding, and you should have a mechanism for doing something about it. We're not saying what the standards should be. I guess if pushed, I would say it's preferable to respond in time that isn't geological. It's helpful if you get a response before you finish the course, maybe. It's helpful if you get marked work back from time to time, yeah? And it's helpful if it's actually got some sort of formative, it's got the odd remark on it, yeah? But it's not up to us to have standards, but we expect an institution that is working through us to have its own standards and to monitor them. And one of the roles we're doing is brokering that. So we're finding that universities that have been more traditional don't have any of that. But when we put them in touch with universities that are less traditional, such as our Open University, a useful dialogue occurs, as a result of which we think benefit to learners happens. You know, there's a transfer of knowledge which is to the benefit of our system. So quality assurance does matter. We're not being intrusive, but we're trying to broker and facilitate people doing it. Right, two more to go. What's our big aim in life? This, for those of you that haven't been reading vertically, this one's worth. Well, they were all worth reading vertically, but this one's. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to do selected areas we're targeting. We're trying to move more into undergraduate programs, bachelor's programs. We've got this organisation called the Quality Assurance Agency, which is trying on a national level to define what they call benchmarks, which are what might one reasonably expect an end of first year student to know, all right, in each major discipline area. Hence the supporting these things called 1+2s, which is you do 1 year electronically and come to the university for the last 2 years of your bachelor's, thereby saving you a lot of money in, and also allowing you to do the first year at your own pace, because we're seeing learners want to change their pattern of learning much more than in the past, both locally with it when they're at university. I don't know whether it's the same here, but more of our students have jobs, are doing something to earn money on the side, and we're finding we can't impose our timetables to the same extent on students as we used to be able to. So again, having any electronic material available on campus is important, so that those that miss it, you take advantage of the displacement in time and space that electronic delivery allows you to do. With fine granularity, so we're hoping, and we're already seeing regeneration in our market share. We're hoping, the bit I haven't dwelt on is often you put on variations of courses for particular large-scale organisations, or you have variations for geographic territories. If you're doing a geography course, for instance, having the main thing, the main year's example built with large quantities of snow built in, doesn't go down too well if you're in, again, Saudi Arabia or whatever. You know, you've got to change examples, if nothing else. You're not changing the learning outcomes, you're changing the examples used to illustrate. Or if you've got an MBA which has a, you want to sell to Shell, you produce a petroleum version. We've got an international targeted, with various relations with universities, and the idea is that we'd be entrepreneurial. And I put that as the final foil. Is this timing all right, Sandra? Have I gone on too long? Yeah. Those are the lessons I think we've learned in the UK so far about e-learning. What is it that we feel are the key things? If you're embarking on an e-learning future, what do you need to do? And the first and the biggest lesson is e-learning is a team game. There are very few universities with the resources to go it alone. You need partners. You need to be able to share with other universities. I would say preferably ones that speak your language. Yeah. We just about get by with the problems we have between England and US. English learning often needs a major rewrite for a US market and vice versa. And the language is more or less the same. I don't mean the trivial things like replacing all the S's in words like subsidised by Z's for the American spelling, or indeed the tool that takes infinitives and splits them in order to make you to maximally split an infinitive is something we don't do. I don't mean all of that nonsense stuff, but actually the deep meaning of words changes. It does need, so that's the first lesson, it's a team game. It does need a project managing role. You need to plan it. And that's something that normal academic structures don't always support optimally. Academic structures are designed usually so that a planning mentality is sort of castigated, is not accepted as being, and there's good reasons for that, but this is one where you do actually have to do a little planning. It's much less easy to change your notes or your foils on the fly, on sort of to include something like this at the last moment if it's being e-delivered around the world, yeah? And there's a quality procedure. This, by the way, was changed on the fly about 25 minutes ago. You do need tutorial support. Any assumption that distance learning is just about putting your materials up and then saying, get on with it, come back when you've finished, that works for some things, but you've really got to provide the sort of support you provide on campus, albeit electronically. There are advantages in it being asynchronous. There's lots of advantages in it being asynchronous. I.e., you're not there to, you can respond when you're ready. In fact, it's a much healthier environment for both. There are times when synchronicity is useful, but there are times when campus learning would benefit from asynchronously, when saves flares up and things. Therefore, I'm suggesting that any e-learning material you develop should be available on campus. Students can benefit from it, even if they're also doing the traditional things. So don't treat it as something separate and second class. Integrate it, or even separate and first class. You need to understand the pedagogy, but that's just the same as needing to understand the pedagogy for what you do at the moment. And that's a painful lesson for some of our colleagues, or at least it may not be the case here, but in the UK, discovering that you needed to know something about how to teach in order to teach medieval dentistry, as well as something about medieval dentistry, was a very painful process that we went through about 7 or 8 years ago. Brand is important. In other words, there are universities around the world that take lectures of somebody whose background is standing up and giving polished performances, not me, but this kind of thing, tape it and put it out and say that's the course. You get away with this for so long, even if you are called Stanford. Yeah, that Stanford is the classic example. There's, and they sold lots of it, but they don't sell so much of it now. The world has moved on. There's a few US ones get away with that. So brand by itself gets you so far, but you've actually got to know what you're doing after a while. Yeah. And the other thing I'd say is you've got to be aware of what's happening in the standards world. You don't want to get stuck with a product that's about to cease, or set of products, or a method of doing things that's about to cease to be fashionable. And therefore don't get too hung in on the hardware too early. The hardware is the least of your problems. It's getting the academic thought right, and getting the support of the academics, and getting the support of the learners, that matters. Sorry, that was a very transmissive mode. That's exactly what you shouldn't do, by the way. E-learning should not be person standing up at the front and preaching. It should be much more interactive. But I'm sorry about the transmissiveness. I hope that was a discussion. So I'd happily take questions at this point.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Thank you.
I can't speak for all of us, but for me it was, apart from all the transmissiveness, which is due to the fact that there are so many people here and so few time available, I think it was more than just being transmissive.
Thank you.
So I think you deal with questions.
Yeah, sure.
Yourself.